Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and this is the podcast about all things undisclosed. The addenda are a chance to bring some very special guests into the conversation about the podcast and get your questions answered as well. Season 2 of Undisclosed is centered on the State versus Joey Watkins, a 16-year-old Georgia murder case that was never what it seemed. First a traffic accident, then mysterious shooting, then crime of passion. Now with us today are Colin Miller, host of Undisclosed and evidence prof par excellence. Hey Colin, how you doing?
Doing well, John. How about yourself?
Great. We also have two very special guests. We have Rebecca Lavoie, who's a producer of Undisclosed. Rebecca is the co-author of 4 true crime books, including Our Little Secret and Dark Heart. She's also the host of the hit podcast Crime Writers On. By day, Rebecca oversees digital news and program content for New Hampshire Public Radio, where her team has won several national awards for multi-platform journalism, including 2 Edward R. Murrow Awards. Another special guest we have today is Professor Marcia Shatlin. She's an associate professor of history and African-American studies at Georgetown University. She's a scholar of African-American life and culture, a national speaker on social movements past and present, including Black Lives Matter, and she hosts Office Hours, a podcast. Hey, Marcia, how you doing?
I am great. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, first, can you tell me a little bit about Office Hours as a podcast?
So I host a weekly podcast. It's a wonderful look at just what college students are like today. And one of the things that I think is really cool is that so many of my students are interested in criminal justice reform.
Well, that gives me hope. Now, Marcia, you have informed me that you are, in fact, an undisclosed super fan.
In an unhealthy way.
So it's disturbing. So it's like it's gotten to hoarding. You know, you buy a bunch of Top Ramen and just sit in the house for days. Is that what we're looking at?
What I love about Undisclosed is the educational value. I feel like I've gone to law school over the course of a season and a few episodes. But I love that Colin and Susan and Rabia are just informing the public about such important issues.
How did you discover Undisclosed?
I was a deep dive into serial. I mean, I'm a 37-year-old college professor, so it's just all NPR and elbow patches in my life. And so I got really into serial. I really appreciated the way that Undisclosed was committed to educating a broad public, but also just the commitment to justice. I think that Rabia's engagement about Islamophobia and about racism in criminal justice, it so aligns with the things that I teach about that Serial became, you know, so integral in talking to my students about what's going on. And then Undisclosed has just done such a masterful job. So I just love it.
What are your impressions of the Joey Watkins case?
I think that there's just all these really interesting things about gender and about Southern dynamics and culture, the small town feel of Rome, and this idea that everyone knows each other's secrets and their business, and the reaction to the Undisclosed team coming to town, I think is really fascinating. But also this idea that women are at the center of all of these battles among men. And that the idea that Joey would go to these lengths to avenge this relationship is so bizarre. But I think it kind of fits into a narrative about the power of women and their ability to do these things to men, even when it doesn't make any sense.
So that power is perceived as threatening?
Well, it seems like it's motivating beyond any kind of reason. I think it was great that Colin opened up with the Helen of Troy metaphor. That was like classic professor move, because I think that historically, especially in the South, women, white womanhood being protected at all costs has animated a lot of racial violence and a lot of panic. And so seeing it play out in the context of what seems to just be really unhealthy relationship behavior, but it doesn't seem to stand on its own as a motivation for a crime, I think is really fascinating, because I think that it's those ideas and tropes that everyone is falling back on.
So in this third episode, Helen of Rome, we learn that the prosecutor in Joey Watkins' case, Tammy Colston, appears to have hung much of her case on Joey's motive for killing Isaac Dawkins, his supposed rage at the fact that his ex-girlfriend Breanne Scarborough had dated Isaac. But the tangled web of teenage relationships in this story doesn't give up its secrets easily. Now, Colin, you brought up the phenomenon of focalization. I hope I'm saying that correctly. Gerard Jeannette's theory that one's perception of people and events is tied to their context and the circumstances that they receive the information in. But isn't this something that happens in almost every case? I mean, there's usually a blizzard of information and accounts from witnesses, you know, much of it contradictory. But juries have to wade through this. They always have. I mean, isn't that built into the system?
Yeah, and it's interesting because there's actually a Supreme Court case, the Sheffer case, where the Supreme Court is saying definitively, we don't have to accept polygraph evidence. And Justice Thomas has a famous quote where he says, the jury is the lie detector. And that's a problem because studies have shown that whether it's jurors, regular people, even people who are trained in the field, they're just not very good at it. And it's not even necessarily lies versus the truth. As you said, with focalization, you sort of have this parade of witnesses coming in, and often it's a battle of these character witnesses where you have some people saying, oh, this defendant's a great guy, he wouldn't harm a fly, and other witnesses saying this is the worst person in the world. And probably the truth is somewhere in between, because we all see a person in a different sphere. I see people at work, in my family, day-to-day life at the grocery store, and you might see the best of the person or the worst of the person. And yeah, I mean, that's – we've pinned people's – innocence and their freedom on the 12 men and women in the jury box, and it is a bit troubling. It might be the best system out there, but certainly there are issues.
One thing I noticed is that there are certain character tropes we impose on narratives as we hear them when I was listening to the podcast. And when I was hearing much of Brianne's account in this case, I found myself associating her with character traits of people I've known who, you know, superficially seem like her. And I was immediately seeing her as that kind of person who draws drama into their life and, you know, despite their many protestations, actually enjoys it. Now, of course, this isn't fair. You know, Brianne is an actual human being. She may not be like this at all, but this was just the impression that I was imposing on it. And I imagine these kind of biases come into play for juries all the time. I mean, how are we supposed to wade through it?
Yeah, John, that's a big problem that we see with juries. There's a natural tendency, it's called modeling, and that is people in the jury box would see a witness and compare that to a friend or relative, etc. And the problem with that, obviously, is there's a lot of baggage associated with people you know, both good and bad, and it's tough to disentangle the two. And referencing back, I'm a big fan of Marcia's podcast as well, Office Hours, because professors do the same thing. You see a student a certain semester and you think, oh, this is just like the student I had before. And the great thing I think about her podcast is it's these one-on-one conversations with this next generation of students, and you really get to see a fuller picture. And it's that picture that often the jurors don't see. They see, again, a sliver of that person on the witness stand without understanding the full context of that person's life.
Which actually brings me to the topic of Brianne's allegations of abuse. As she told it, it involved a fairly long history with many incidents, the hair pulling incident during the accident, the ammonia cleaning fluid that was flung at her in the shower. She was slapped. She claimed she got punched in the ribs on Christmas Eve. All of this superficially completely follows the outline of domestic abuse in relationships. There's no reason that this shouldn't be believable. And in many cases, obviously, women don't come forward specifically because they're worried they won't be believed. So how do we judge allegations of abuse without projecting these things on them?
It's really difficult. I worked at Legal Aid for a summer and worked primarily on domestic violence cases. And it is, as Rabia pointed out in the podcast, just really difficult because the rules that apply in that type of case are just so different than the rules that apply in other cases. And, you know, one of my big hesitations about taking the case this season were these allegations. And, you know, the tough part here is, obviously, we've discussed how that July 1999 shooting wasn't Joey. We had the end of the episode in episode 3 with the Troup County incident, and you would look at those and say, well, that really casts a pall over many of Brianne's allegations in this case, but it's certainly not something you can reject out of hand, and they are troubling allegations, and it is really difficult to assess exactly how much weight we should give them.
This is something that's come up, you know, a few times when my husband and writing partner, Kevin Flynn, and I have been writing books together. At least two of our books have involved teenage women, actually, who in the course of either their defense or in the course of sort of telling their story to police later or in their discourse with people in their community, made allegations of abuse that we couldn't necessarily corroborate nor disprove, but it was an essential part of the prosecution of the case. So what's really tough, and this is what I told the undisclosed team when they were having this discussion and I was listening in, is that all you can do in these instances is say what happened. And if it weren't relevant if she made these accusations of abuse sort of outside the sphere of the prosecution, if Susan heard that she had been gossiping about it. It's very different than if it is actually part of the fabric of the state's story in the prosecution, which in this case it was. I mean, it is relevant to talk about because it is part of the narrative. And all you can do is tell the audience, this is what she said happened. I think to make a judgment call on whether or not it happened or not is one thing, but to also throw out, this is also what she said that looks like it's not true. You know, you let the, sort of let the audience or the reader or the listeners decide what they feel about those allegations in that instance. But it is a tricky line. And I think in this case, it's relevant to bring in just because it's such a crucial part of the prosecution.
One of the things that I think is interesting about this case, in contrast to Adnan's, is that it really helps challenge people who want to do criminal justice reform and think about exoneration, about what happens when you don't have the perfect person. And I think that in delving into a case that is complicated with a person who admittedly has done a lot of bad things, it makes the larger public really think carefully about what a justice system is supposed to do and how it can't proceed because a person is unlikable. And I think that this issue comes up a lot in a lot of the ways we talk about police shootings and Black Lives Matter, and it doesn't matter kind of what we think of a person. What does it mean for everyone to have an opportunity to have access to justice?
That was certainly a central theme in Making a Murderer, the Stephen Avery case.
Oh, absolutely.
Even. You sort of have somebody who's living in tremendous amounts of poverty, who has, you know, a life story that's not a life that anybody would be, you know, necessarily proud to have lived, you know, abused animals and so forth, and yet deserves fairness in the justice system, just like everybody else.
Well, I've noticed a scary impulse by people to label people by actions they've taken. Like anybody who transgresses becomes labeled a criminal. And thus, once they are a criminal, has to be dealt with a certain set of expectations, as though the time that they have transgressed once defines who they are. And we find in these cases, we're dealing with people who are highly imperfect people. And people on juries and in the court system have a tendency to label them. Even when they've been through the incarceration process, then they're labeled ex-convicts and they cease to be human. And people cease to give them the rights that humans should have. Now, I actually had a question for Colin. Has Joey admitted any of the abuse that Breanne's alleged?
No, Joey does not have the same recollection of any of the incidents that Breanne mentioned. You know, for instance, the mall incident at Christmas time, that's something where Joey says there was some type of confrontation. Someone sort of jumped on his back and reflex wise, he was responding, but there was no, you know, volitional punch. There was nothing where intentionally he was seeking to harm Breanne. It was sort of a spur-of-the-moment situation where someone jumped on him and he reacted reflexively. So again, it's something where I think what we tried to express in the episode was there was at least a grain of truth to everything stated in there, but the shading is really important. And again, we can't say anything definitively. It's just to say there are some inconsistencies there, and certainly different people have different perspectives on what happened.
So Rebecca, I actually have a question. As you and your husband are writing these true crime books, do you keep focalization in mind and try to be super careful about how you describe people and how you describe events?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'm the first to admit I am the worst perpetrator between the two of us. Like, I'm the person who will be like, you know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of that guy who used to date my friend. And then, you know, and focalization is, it's not good, but it actually can be a valuable tool to help you explore things that sometimes can lead you somewhere. Obviously, that's not what you want your jurors to do. But as writers, sometimes I will get clues from behavior that's been reported or an interview that we do that will lead me down a path based on my experiences, and I'll end up finding something there. And so what I have to do is just always sort of just pull myself back, remember the same rules that we use in the newsroom where I work, that just like corroborate all of the source material you can, and make sure that you can source everything and not make assumptions. But sometimes assumptions turn out to bear fruit in the writing process. So it's a little bit of a trickier situation.
And do you get pressure from publishers to sort of jazz it up and make it have more of a point of view?
No, actually, you know, we work with a major publishing house, Penguin Random House, and our manuscripts are vetted for a period of about a month by a legal team who has us source every conversation, every quote, every fact that we state in the book. And, you know, in our last book, we had some stuff that isn't typical that you're able to gather as an author, especially the state the case ours was in, because we had access to all these court records, which was basically like 800 pages of Facebook messages between the perpetrator and his accomplice. And we got a lot of questions about, how do you know this is what he thought? And I was able to say, because it says right here, I think this. So no.
That helps.
We're actually not asked to jazz it up at all. I mean, I know I'm certain there are publishers that did or do that kind of thing, but we are not working with one of those, and I'm happy that we are not.
When I was writing my book, I had offhandedly mentioned that one of my friends growing up was gay, and I got a call from the lawyer at Penguin, who coincidentally puts out my book, and they said, okay, we got to ask, is he still gay? and I ended up having to call him and saying, hey, man, just out of curiosity, are you still gay? He is. He's happily married to another guy. Just FYI.
Fact checking.
Yes, exactly. Actually, Marsha, I wanted to circle back about the abuse thing with you for a moment, because I know that your area of expertise is the effect of police brutality on women of color and how often in those situations sexual abuse comes into play. And obviously, in the case of Daniel Holtzclaw, that police officer who was abusing women for, what, over a decade, I believe? Obviously, the women in that situation felt in no way that they could come forward. And I'm trying to think, how do we build a legal framework that supports women coming forward and being truthful, but also protects the rights of the accused?
I think that this is probably one of the most challenging things to engage my students about, or for me to wrap my head around. What does it mean if we take seriously A, criminal defense, and B, a process in which a person can be held accountable for their behavior? But also, I think that rehabilitation part, we have to really also believe that there are mechanisms to help people who have hurt other people, I mean, in its most basic level. But what we find in the justice system is that the long and pervasive impact of stereotyping on who we see as a victim and who we don't see as a victim. And so when we think about police brutality as only happening to men or only happening to men of color, we lose sight of the various ways that women can be victimized. And we also, I think, lose sight of who believes that they have the right or they have access to police. And so I think what's interesting in this case is that you have a lot of young people who are using the police as a resource, in the sense that they feel like they can call them, they can tell them what's happening, and they have a trust with the police. But when we have communities that have had such negative personal and historical relationships to the police and policing, then where do they go to get some type of relief? And so I think that all of these issues, when we think about criminal justice reform, we don't just start with, okay, the system is broken. We think about, where in the society do we have some real cracks and fault lines? And it's often about who we think is valuable and who we think is disposable.
So you're saying that the legal framework isn't necessarily where we need to approach this?
It's all hands on deck. We have to think about it in terms of, if you care about criminal justice reform, then you are working on eradicating racism in all its form, in housing and in employment and in everyday life, in the words you use and what you act like in front of your kids, right? It's some of this big picture stuff, because as Colin was talking about, you know, the justice system relies on juries. It relies on judges that are either appointed or elected. It relies on structures that fund criminal defense or not. And so in many ways, you know, we can't just look at this system as the one that's reflective of some problems. Rather, we think, okay, there is a whole structure underneath that we have to work on. And I think that in thinking deeply about these issues, we get closer and closer to solving those problems.
Well, I certainly hope so. Now, I wanted to go to some Twitter questions, if that's okay with everybody. We got one from Alyssa, who says, I have a question for the addendum. I wonder how the police there are reacting to the investigation. Good, bad, indifferent?
I guess all of the above would be the correct response. So we've seen sort of the entire spectrum as to how people have responded to this investigation.
Another question from Brooke Carter. Is Brianne aware of the podcast? And would she be interviewed to clarify about the July shooting incident?
Yeah, she was called several months ago in connection with the case and essentially refused to talk. And then before we premiered this third episode, we reached out to her again, sent her emails to various accounts that we think are connected to her, and have not, as far as I know at least, gotten a response from her.
Okay, and we have another question from B. Sens, and she says, can Brianne or anyone perpetuating rumors that landed Joey in jail be charged with any crime for their false statements?
No, there wouldn't typically. Well, if you make an official statement to police, there is in many jurisdictions the crime of false reporting of a crime. So that potentially could lead to charges being brought against one. So like in the Casey Anthony case, I seem to remember in that case that the mother who was on trial had made accusations against the nanny, I believe, and I think that there were charges brought against that for false allegations of a crime. If it's just sort of in the community or among the group of friends saying this person did that or whatnot, that would not be grounds for any type of criminal charges.
So, John, is it okay if I ask Colin a quick question about the podcast?
Please proceed.
We heard in this episode that Brianne filed her complaint against Joey's harassing phone calls, allegedly stalking her, in his parole file. How would someone even know how to do that? I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, I mean, unless you knew someone in law enforcement, you really likely wouldn't know that. Most people probably don't even know about the parole process. Yeah, I mean, you'd have to imagine that she did a good deal of research to figure out, here is the process I followed to file this complaint with the parole board so that when he goes up for parole, it's going to be there in his file and work against him getting that parole.
Is it possible that any kind of reports like that are automatically put in the parole file?
Now, I'm pretty sure in this case, she actually made a separate complaint to go in the parole file because the initial criminal complaint was dismissed against Joey. I'm not sure whether what she did initially in the case, the criminal complaint, would be put into that profile.
She does seem to have a remarkable comfort with the justice system. I mean, she brought him to court back when the shooting incident was discussed, although she didn't bring him to court specifically for that, right? It was for something else.
Right. It wasn't specifically that July 1999 shooting when Joey was in Panama City. That, I think, was sort of part of a pattern of behavior she alleged, and we don't have the exact documentation to show what else she was alleging. What we do know, again, though, is that that was a big part of that hearing, and when Joey could establish he was in Panama City, that was why the judge dismissed it and said this is, you know, typical teenage drama.
I've got one more Twitter question, actually. This is from P. Megarella, who asks, I'm confused about the timeline. Did Joey date Brianne again after she accused him of shooting at her? And the reason I think this is an interesting question is because she later alleged a whole pattern of abuse. But again, this conforms to the pattern of many relationships that have domestic abuse in them, that people stay in the relationship despite of it. So I imagine she did stay with him after that. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So Joey dated Brianne on and off until, I think, early 1999. Then she dated Isaac, including during July 1999 when the shooting supposedly took place. And then later that fall, Joey and Brianne dated again before Joey broke it off later that year. And yeah, again, it's complicated. You can't say that just because they dated after these events that there was no abuse in the past. There's the fading effect bias that says you tend to remember the good and forget the bad. And that's why in so many of these situations, whether it's just a bad relationship or an abusive relationship, you do see this cycle where people might break up or break it off and then get back together into a bad relationship. So we're not sure here, but yes, after this July 1999 event, the supposed shooting when Joey was in Panama City, Brianne and Joey did get back together again.
And interestingly, when I was reading contemporaneous news reports of the trial, they kept consistently labeling Joey a stalker and a bully, which surprised me. Obviously, this is journalism and they're supposed to eschew those sort of things. But it's interesting because it hasn't, in my understanding of the case from what I've gotten from Undisclosed, that hasn't been the case when they investigate the actual actions that occurred.
Right. We've covered a few of the incidents where there was alleged to be poor decisions made by Joey, to put it lightly, and a lot of those turn out not to be true. And we'll get to more of those going forward. There is, I think, probably that article is relying upon a specific incident that had testimony at trial, and it was considered maybe the most important piece of character evidence against Joey. And that becomes pretty interesting because what's testified to at Joey's trial very much changes when that same witness testifies at the trial of his co-defendant, Mark Free, and calls into question this characterization in the article. There's a lot of things in the news articles that turn out not to be true or not to accurately represent what actually happened at the trial.
So which witness was that, may I ask?
The witness, you know, and again, it's the article could be referring to any number, but it would be Yvonne Agon, who we will be discussing going forward, but she was a very important witness at Joey's trial and then turned out to be much less important at Mark Free's trial.
Interesting. So, Rebecca, do you have any more questions?
The thing that is sort of, to me, really sticks out is that the teenage-ness of all of this. And one of the books that we wrote did have teenagers as central characters, at least when they committed the crime, they were teenagers. And there is sort of a heightened like relationship narrative around teenagers and there is around adults, and that certain behaviors that when you're a teenager are just drama. When you're a teenager, when you look at it as an adult, it's like, no, that's abuse. That's not drama. And I'm wondering how well, Colin, you think the justice system, juries do in sort of parsing out like what's teenage stuff and what's that lens is just a little fuzzy, right?
One of the things that I think is interesting about this case, again, these dynamics of a small town in the South, while none of this behavior is isolated to that context, I think the dating culture of teenagers having very serious and intense relationships is considered positive. I used to be on the faculty of the University of Oklahoma, and I think it's interesting that a lot of the young women I taught, relationships were really, really valued in their family and in their town. You know, adults knew who were the homecoming king and queen and who was involved with each other. And I think as someone who came from a big city, I always thought it was weird how much adults kind of encouraged that. And I think it has to do with, you know, getting married early or, you know, staying in, some of these things that we label traditional values. So I think that teenageness of bad, abusive, unhealthy boundary stuff always concerns me because I think it normalizes a lot of the verbal abuse that we see back and forth between these two.
Right.
But I also think another element of it is the fact that the context in which the relationship is happening is also so much structured by people knowing everything and there always being an audience for this. So I definitely think that there's something to be said about the context in which it's happening. I was going to say another thing. I forgot.
Well, I think that even comes out in Joey talking about cruising, right? Because cruising is not something that happens everywhere. And cruising is just an activity that has to do with driving around so you can see people and so they can see you.
Oh, what I was going to say about Joey that I think is also interesting is that every incident involving him is about being really reactive. And this crime, if we're supposed to believe one of the prosecution theories of it, it seems really calculated and really specific. That he goes from a person who has like an anger control problem to someone who's masterminding killing someone in a highway. There's something about that also seems just very strange to me.
They do seem like very different skill sets.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Perhaps that's the wrong choice of words. Well, interestingly, I grew up in New York City where all of those normal teenage societal bonds don't really exist. You go to a massive school full of thousands of kids. When I was a kid, it was uncool to participate in a lot of the normal teenage rituals. And in a way, our socialization was very, very different because of that. Mm-hmm. We were not hyper aware of status, things like that. We could buy out of that system. Rebecca, what were you going to bring up?
I agree. I mean, I grew up in the tri-state area as well. But even where I live now in New Hampshire, like my kids go to a tiny school. Do not date people in school. Do not get serious because I got to go to school with them again next year. And the parents, as parents in my community, we're all like, whoa, what do you mean you have a girlfriend? You know, it's very much seen as like, don't take this seriously. And you're right. I think there is something cultural to it. I think that's a very, very interesting angle that I hadn't thought of.
There's a racial element to all of this also. When we look at accountability and the move to sentence juveniles as adult, a lot of that was informed by the changing racial demographics of large urban areas. And part of what I research is why African-American children specifically are not considered children in various contexts. And so I think that there is also an element of boys will be boys, kids just having fun, that has a lot to do with race and class as well.
I was reading your bio, Marcia, and one particular statistic that was mentioned in your work just stunned me, which was that black girls are disproportionately pushed out of school and into the criminal and juvenile justice system. Although they make up just 16% of America's female student population, black girls account for more than one third of all female arrests that take place on our school campuses. I'm sorry, that blew my mind. I had no frame of reference to take that in.
A person who's done great research on this is a woman named Monique Morris, who wrote a book called Push Out about the criminalization of African-American girls. And she talks about it in a modern context. And I trace it in my work from the early 20th century, that when you have a critical mass of children of color who are coming from the South to cities like Chicago and New York and Los Angeles, you have a criminal justice system that really believes in incarcerating juveniles or underfunding opportunities for youth. And so that is also a large part of the origins of the criminal justice problems that we see today. It's hyper criminalizing children.
Yeah. And Marcia, I wanted to follow up with you on that, because I know, you know, a big part of that too is the rise of zero tolerance policies in schools and this whole idea of the school to prison pipeline. And I'd love for you to share with our listeners, you know, some of the data and thinking on that.
Well, you know, school to prison pipeline is a framework for people to think about the ways that school policies around discipline and around keeping school safe, their origins come from some reaction to school integration and others about the criminalization of poverty. And so people who do this research often think about the presence of police officers, of metal detectors, the fact that schools are doing, you know, the version of the three strikes, you're out, but with kids. And so the more and more young people are out of school, the more and more they are vulnerable to becoming victims of crime or finding themselves perpetrators of crime. And so I think that a lot of really important justice work is tied to thinking about not why people commit crimes, but what are the structures that are mirroring a lot of the expectations of the criminal justice system? And so school to prison pipeline research has been so helpful in helping teachers and school administrators think about the ways that we've adapted a lot of the practices of prisons and jails and given them to kids. And I think that one of the things that is really important to keep in mind, again, that if people really want to get involved in reforming the system, they have to start with the schools and the communities and the resources available to kids.
Now, Rebecca, I have a question. Do your kids go to a school with metal detectors at the door?
Nope. My kids go to a school with I went to a school with metal detectors at the door. Yeah. My kids go to a school that is shockingly non-metal detectory. I think it's good that it can be, but it is. That was a big culture shock to me when I first moved to New Hampshire, was how it seems that isn't even in the thinking of schools. I mean, the philosophy seems to be that sort of proactively, I think, where I live, that if you do that, you are pointing to something that they would like to work on in other ways. At least that's my optimistic view of why there are no metal detectors in my kids' schools.
Well, it was interesting. I went to New York City schools in the 70s, and obviously the 70s was a very troubled time for New York City. So you didn't have to throw the kids into prison from school. The schools already felt like prisons. We had metal detectors. We had metal grates.
Cops?
I had cops at high school, not in junior high and in elementary school. Actually, my elementary school felt fairly lighthearted and rural in some respects, even though it was on 96th Street. But by high school, it was – and I understand this. You know, parents demand safety for their children at school. It was a time when there were enormous fears of street gangs. And in my mind, honestly, a lot of those fears were misplaced. I went to the Bronx High School of Science. Our street gangs had Rubik's Cubes. I never felt for a moment in my high school that my safety was at risk. But we had metal detectors and cops. And I do recall a couple of fights that, you know, got out of hand, and there was some sort of intercession by the police. But do you believe this is an overreaction?
From my perspective, two things have, I think, happened to animate this. The first one is the type of mass shootings that we see in places like Columbine, although they're happening in economically advantaged schools with a lot of white students, the anxiety about school shootings and trickle down to all schools. And I think that there's a real bias in thinking how some kids need to be safe and how other kids need to be held in line. So that in poor communities and in communities of color, safety means putting police officers in the building and treating students like they're in a prison. I think in more affluent communities, it's lockdown drills and it's procedures about an outside threat. And so I think that there is a panic about safety that, you know, we're all familiar with because people are watching the news and they're seeing these horrible images. And in light of all the data that tells us that this is probably the safest we've ever been in terms of crime, the reaction to it and how different communities get those resources are just so unequal.
Well, also, people's risk assessment is completely off. I mean, obviously, the likelihood of a school shooting is minuscule. If you want to worry about things, there's so many other things you can worry about.
Well, they're real things. I mean, you know, in my tiny town, you can go on the anonymous social media sites where the high school kids post, and you see them posting, you know, sexually abusive remarks.
Yes.
And you see them talking about, you know, pills and, you know, the kind of drugs that can't be sniffed out by dogs. I mean, this is like, you have to know where to look. And I think you can never, ever see a shooter coming. You can never see that coming. But there are things happening that we're just not looking at because we are, as a society, preoccupied with big, dark, scary danger in a way that is, I think, keeping us from being able to look at what's really going on. I think about this a lot with this Joey Watkins case. I mean, this relationship that was, you know, maybe condoned by adults, the sort of intense level of relationships that were happening among these kids. But what were the parents focused on? They were focused on, you know, what kind of cars their kids were driving or whether or not there was a fight that was going to happen at their house. It's an interesting cultural disparity there.
Yeah, and I don't want to blame the parents, obviously, because we have no idea what their interactions were. Marcia, now, being that you're an undisclosed fan, do you have any big questions about the Watkins case that you'd like to throw at Colin?
The McDonald's thing is so confusing to me about the harassment claim that Breanne makes. Is she suggesting that Joey was on some type of work prisoner excursion? The McDonald's thing was the part that I was so fixated on that I couldn't figure out.
Yeah, and that's something where we don't have a clear answer because the question is Joey misconstruing what happened? Did Breanne make a claim that he was at McDonald's? But right, yeah, I mean, the point is he was in prison. He was never on work release. There's no way he was at McDonald's. The question is, and we're not sure, did Breanne ever make that allegation or did somehow that information in a perverted form get to Joey? And that's why he was thinking the allegation related to him being at McDonald's.
Got it.
Do you have a list? Do you have a checklist of things that you're going down now?
Maybe I'll go to the first 100. I guess my other question about doing an investigation like this, the questions about, you know, public information and access to records, I think, is really interesting, especially as a historian. When the undisclosed team can't get material, what are people telling you?
Yeah, I mean, it is essentially the claim that these audio tapes aren't public information or the information doesn't exist. We've encountered that both seasons. The season one with Adnan trying to get the Crime Stoppers information, we have documentation from Crime Stoppers about this tip, and yet when we make the Information Act requests to the relevant police departments, they're saying it's not there. And then in the Joey Watkins case, when we're trying to get this documentation, sometimes at first they say we're not obligated to give it. Other times it doesn't exist. And then sometimes it turns up eventually. I'm actually recently now in Adnan's case trying to get information related to Jay's stet on March 5th. And we've gone through maybe 5 or 6 different routes. Those didn't work. And now there might be a 6th route that might have more information. So it's a variety of reasons that they give. And sometimes they seem valid. Sometimes they don't seem to hold that much water.
It is a bureaucratic quagmire. It really is. And this is something that I've experienced a lot. It's that very often, you know, as much as I think in Anand's case, as people who've been following the case, we're thinking that's obstruction. But very often what it is people working in an office who are like, I don't have time to give that to you. I can't give that to you. Like, that's just, I have to check and see if I can give that. And there's just like a lot of requests. There are a lot of people asking for things, and it can be a bureaucratic quagmire. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's like the term is overused, but I mean, it literally is Kafkaesque when you think about I mean, that's one of my favorite novels is The Trial. And I mean, this is essentially what it's about is a person has been charged with a crime and it's almost like this nameless, faceless prosecution. And you're trying to get information, trying to figure things out. But it's just this bureaucratic state that leaves you in this state of limbo when you're really just trying to prove your innocence.
I had a question. So the Crime Stoppers tip, they're now claiming that they don't have the paperwork on it. They don't even know that information anymore?
Well, so we got written documentation from Metro Crime Stoppers itself saying there was a $3,075 reward. There was a tip on February 1st, and it was paid out in full on, I believe, November 1st. So from Crime Stoppers, they've always said that the information exists. When we have made the request to the relevant police departments, they have come back and said that they have no documentation. Now, as we've said, the person, at least in Baltimore County, in charge of those Public Information Act requests is the attorney who made the arguments at Adnan's bail hearing about the pattern of Pakistani jilted boyfriends killing their girlfriends and going to Pakistan. So she obviously has an interest in not releasing documentation that's going to make Baltimore look bad. But yeah, right now we're not getting it. If there is a retrial, and it's looking possibly more and more likely that there could be, then there would be subpoena power for Justin Brown and the defense team, and that might force some more answers.
Got it. But if the actual documentation doesn't exist, then no answers can be had then.
Well, they could subpoena the lead detectives on the case, Ritz and McGillivary. They could get them under oath because the way it works is the Crime Stoppers, this full tip amount of $3,075 is paid out. The way that works is the lead detective on the case goes through everything that the tipster provided, has a checklist, and is checking off different things to determine, did they get part of the reward, the full reward, etc. So either McGillivary or Ritz seemingly has to know the identity of the tipster, and if they're called to the witness stand, either they're going to plead the fifth or presumably they're going to answer as to who that person is.
Was there Crime Stoppers abuse, like systematic abuse by detectives who were using Crime Stopper funds to get witnesses to give statements?
Yeah, and this is documented. Metro Crime Stoppers, the same organization that had the tip in Adnan's case, I believe a year or two later, there was an expose where there was massive corruption, both by a person at Crime Stoppers, and people also said that the detectives were sort of using it as a slush fund. So, yeah, I mean, certainly there was a lot of misconduct involved with Metro Crime Stoppers.
That makes one of the biggest arguments for a retrial. Obviously, nobody wishes for Adnan Syed to stay in prison for another day for something that he did not do. But I don't know how all of this is going to get publicized and cleaned up unless these people are brought to account. Are there going to be other avenues to pursue?
Yeah, and if you've listened to the podcast breakdown, the Justin Chapman case where Georgia decided they're not going to re-prosecute him, there was a reward in that case. The Joy Watkins case, we'll get to this later in the season, there was a significant monetary award in this case, and there are big questions related to that. The question is, will anything be done? The answer is probably not. I can't think of a single case where a person has been prosecuted for Crime Stoppers abuse. And when there's not any type of follow-up like that, there's not a disincentive to engage in that type of abuse.
Well, but just revealing that it's going on, I think, would be an enormous public service, don't you think?
Yeah, and that's the tough part is, and I've sort of toyed with the idea, and maybe someone out there will take the torch on it, is it's so tough to say. On balance, is Crime Stoppers efficacious in that does it tend to lead to, on average, mostly guilty people being caught? Are the abuses a small minority of cases and we risk throwing out the baby with the bathwater by doing a rigorous investigation? Or is it that in a decent chunk of cases, there is this abuse and the leading to people pointing the finger at the wrong person? That's what I'd love to know. I mean, I think there should be some reform, but the question is how big is the problem? And I'm not sure of the enormity of the problem.
Well, okay, last chance, ladies, to throw questions at Colin.
I actually have a question if we have time that I would love to throw to the three of you.
It was super fun to work with Molly Ringwald, if that's what you're about to ask.
Yes, that's what I meant.
No, go ahead, Colin.
Well, it seemed like the perfect opportunity because We have, on the one hand, the person who created the Ferguson syllabus, which was crowdsourcing people, bringing in music and films, et cetera, to talk about criminal justice. We have the host of Crime Writers On, and we have you, John Cryer, who's been involved in, you know, Hollywood and pop culture for so many years. I mean, what is all of the takes that you three have about what effect pop culture can and should have on educating students, on the way that people view the criminal justice system, the police, et cetera?
You know, what you just said about Crime Stoppers and how there have been, I believe you said, articles and reports on this Crime Stopper issue. And yet those journalists, their work is not being seen, heard, cared about by those of us who are asking questions about it. You know, you'll say there's a scandal that breaks. Oh, the New York Times reported on that 10 months ago. The only way to get people in the United States, it seems, to really pay attention to things is to invest them in a pop culture project. I mean, if you look at the fact that Dean Strang has become a folk hero in America because of his, you know, adorable sweater vest justice crusade and making a murderer and all the issues he brought forth. If you look at movies like The Thin Blue Line, if you look at Serial and just the attention that's put on the criminal justice reform and in the Baltimore police, you look at The Wire, this is how you get people to care. I'm not saying that that's ideal. I mean, as a journalist by day, of course you want everyone to read your story and go, oh God, but it's really the great TV show, movie, book, or podcast that gets people talking. And I really think in some ways it's today almost the only way to get stuff done.
Well, I think there's a cognitive disconnect. You can hear information, but until you experience it on an emotional level, it doesn't really affect you. And that's one of the great things that pop culture is capable of.
One of the things that I like about social media as an academic is that I think it's just an opportunity for people to come closer to a set of ideas or problems that they may not have access to. I know that some of my colleagues find Twitter, you know, an unacceptable way to have intellectual dialogue, but I think it's an incredible space for smart people to talk about smart things and bring people closer to it. And so I think that without social media and without pop culture really wanting to engage this issue of criminal justice reform, people would not have access to some of the big issues that are associated with it. And I think it also helps them understand ways that they can actually be part of the solution.
Well, I think it also it gives a very interesting pathway to, you know, as bad as social media can be, some people find it, you know, emotionally very draining and awful. It's also a pathway right into the human id. You know, people are willing to be horrible on social media. And I think that actually, you know, once you step back and you understand we're now dealing with input from millions of human beings across the planet Earth, you can sort of take it in a much more generalized fashion and not take it personally. Well, I just wanted to thank you guys so much for being here today. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you, Marcia. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Colin, it wasn't so great talking to you.
It never is.
But thank you so much. And hopefully we'll be talking about more episodes of Undisclosed soon. So as a lot of you know, I'll be donating my fees from the addendum to organizations helping the wrongly convicted. So this week, I will be sending my fees to the Michigan Innocence Clinic at Michigan Law. Clinic students investigate and litigate cases on behalf of prisoners who have new evidence that may establish that they are actually innocent of the crimes for which they were found guilty. Unlike many other innocence clinics, which specialize in DNA exonerations, the Michigan Innocence Clinic focuses on innocence cases where there is no biological evidence to be tested. The Michigan Innocence Clinic has already exonerated 7 of its clients since its inception in 2009. Now, I would give you the URL for the website of the Michigan Innocence Clinic, except that it's wildly long and complicated and ridiculous. So just Google it, for God's sakes. It's Michigan Innocence Clinic. Oh, and by the way, that organization was sent to me by Brooke Giddings of the Actual Innocence podcast. And if you haven't given that a listen, please do. You will not be disappointed. Now, fans can discuss the show on Twitter at #undisclosed or #JoeyWatkins. If you want to tag questions for future addenda, you can use #UDaddendum, or you can tweet them directly to me at Mr. John Cryer. Also, if you've got any worthy organizations for the wrongfully convicted that you'd like for me to consider donating to and highlighting on the show, let me know that as well. And as always, there will be new case documents posted weekly at undisclosed-podcast.com. I often find intriguing tidbits in there and a million new questions every week. Follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project at GA Innocence. I want to thank Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media for audio production. I want to give a big shout out to Patrick Cortez for composing the new addenda theme, and also a huge thank you to Methil Telhan as our project manager. And sadly, I will not be hosting next week's addendum. I'll be traveling and unavailable, but we'll have somebody great to sub in for me, as well as some fantastic guests. And I'll be back the week after, and I swear you won't even have missed me. But I'll have missed you. Bye-bye, and thanks again.